Last week we began chapter 17, the soul and nature in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge and the Synthesis of Yoga, which was published on the 15th of April in 1917. And he noted at the beginning that Integral Yoga takes up the various strands of the nature and brings them together, to gather them up, to recombine them. It is an aim to awaken the spirit within the individual to the sublimity of its original nature, but to get its arms around all that's in its manifest nature and bring it into a living oneness with the world and with the transcendent reality. It is to become sovereign in its own nature, a conscious point of full awareness from top to toe that brings the universe into the person and the person into the universe. So it's a big program. The Integral Yoga is vast. We'll take it up about halfway through with this paragraph. To arrive by an intense spirituality at the absolute of the soul is our possibility on one side of our dual existence. To enjoy the absolute of nature and of everything in nature is our possibility on the other side of this eternal duality. To unify these highest aspirations in a divine possession of God and ourselves and the world should be our happy completeness. So we began from that in our absoluteness. We have come here. The purpose of the cosmos is to rejoin all the strands together, to take these poles of being, because they really are still one being, simply polar in their distance and definition of each other. But spirit and nature are not antagonistic, and yoga is meant to prove that. A happy completeness means that we become purnam, we become full. Only the full is happy. In the lower poise, he writes, this is not possible because the soul acts through the mind, and the mind can only act individually and fragmentarily in a contented obedience or a struggling subjection to that universal nature through which the divine knowledge and the divine will are worked out in the cosmos. So the soul doesn't have real possession working through this fragmented consciousness of the mind. But the spirit is in possession of knowledge and will. And let's pause to say that knowledge and will are aspects of chit shakti. But the spirit is in possession of knowledge and will, of which it is the source and cause, and not a subject. Therefore, in proportion as the soul assumes its divine or spiritual being, it assumes also control of the movements of its nature. It becomes, in the ancient language, swarat, free, and a self-ruler over the kingdom of its own life and being. but also it increases in control over its environment, its world. So this knowledge and will acts in nature. When we become sovereign in that seat of soul consciousness, then that conscious power expressing itself in fullness of knowledge, in irresistible will, claims that which it sees as its empire and becomes sovereign over it. So the answer to the questions that nature poses to us, which seem to be antinomous, this is good, that is bad, this is true, that is false, this is strong, that is weak, all of that begins to come under the sway of the spiritual consciousness as it asserts itself in nature. So first we have to realize the spiritual consciousness, but not simply as a static power. And then we have to bring it towards and into nature and let it increasingly express itself. And that's where we achieve the transformation. But first, we have to have that consciousness. But also, it increases in control over its environment, its world. And you'll remember that Sri Aurobindo took careful notes of his extension into the world as he developed his consciousness, as he developed the powers of his consciousness, as those powers began to fructify. In his influence on world events. So that he found that from a distance he could influence not only the people in his ashram, or the people in the city of Pondicherry, but he could, as he became more sovereign, begin to impress upon world events, the flow of economic developments, the shape, the contour of political life. Can you imagine if we had a society of illumined beings, what we might be able to do in the conduct of world affairs? First, rather than swagger as if we have achieved all this already, because Sri Aurobindo has conceived it, we have to do the simple work of discovering within ourselves these recesses that lead us into the soul consciousness, that lead us above to the transcendence and the origination of what we are. But as we go within and as we go above and as we come back to the world, from inside, from a descent of consciousness above, certify those powers in the exercise of the energies of life. So Sri Aurobindo, if you've read his record of yoga, if you've read even a little bit about his autobiography, which are in scattered notes, I agree, you can see how he dispensed with the ego formation itself, so much so that even in dream life, there was no falling back to an identification with a mere instrument. He knew what he was. Waking, sleeping, writing a poem, sending a great thought to world leaders. These great thoughts have to come here somehow. And if not through the awakened sages who silently lead the world, then through whom? So, the soul must offer its conscious direction to life. This it can only do entirely by universalizing itself, for it is the divine and universal will that it must express in its action upon the world. It must first extend its consciousness and see the universe in itself, instead of being, like the mind, limited by the physical, vital, sensational, emotional, intellectual outlook of this little divided personality. It must accept the world truths, the world energies, the world tendencies, the world purposes as its own, instead of clinging to its own intellectual ideas, desires and endeavors, preferences, objects, intentions, impulses. These, so far as they remain, must be harmonized with the universal. It must then submit its knowledge and will at their very source to the divine knowledge and the divine will, and so arrive through submission at emergence, losing its personal light in the divine light and the personal initiative in the divine initiative. To be first in tune with the infinite, in harmony with the divine, and then to be unified with the infinite, taken into the divine, is its condition of perfect strength and mastery. And this is precisely the very nature of the spiritual life and the spiritual existence. So these are actual steps in a dynamic yoga that he's enumerated here. To take this one consciousness, W-O-N, this consciousness that we have won, this serene poise inside, and extend it. To then accept the world forces, no longer to try to control and dominate them, but to become universal and be possessed by them. To then harmonize all these elements, the personal and the universal. To submit. It's a submission to the divine will. It is this act of surrender. It is this opening of the flower to the sun. And then to arrive at this emergence, and another word for emergence is oneness. To do all of that, these are various stages of yoga as it conquers field after field, as it comes back to complete the cosmic question. So this, he says, is precisely the very nature of the spiritual life. This is not a spiritual life abstracted. That's the spiritual existence. This is existence in life. A spiritual existence made living, taking up the forms of the world as its habitation. Back to the Isha Upanishad, the first verse. This is the habitation of the Lord, who dwells in you and experiences the universe not simply as the universe, but in and through you as well, but only perfectly when you're awake. Awake to the nature of the world and awake to that nature. The distinction made in the Gita between the Purusha and the Prakriti gives us the clue to the various attitudes which the soul can adopt towards nature in its movement towards perfect freedom and rule. And let's be a little patient as he unrolls this here, because it's not going to be the same doctrine that we meet in the Sankhya Karikas 1,000 years later. The Gita has a more elastic and permissive understanding of what is Purusha and what is Prakriti and how they secretly meet. The Purusha is, says the Gita, witness, upholder, source of the sanction, knower, Lord, enjoyer. So this is the 13th chapter of the Gita, the 22nd shloka, where the upholder, well, pardon me, the witness is Upadrashta. The upholder is Bharata. The source of the sanction is Anumanta. The knower, Jnanta. The Lord, Maheshwara. The enjoyer is Bhokta. The soul may assume if it wishes. Oh, I didn't read the rest of that sentence. Prakriti executes. It is the active principle and must have an operation corresponding to the attitude of the Purusha, because one is deeply meant to reflect the other. The soul may assume, if it wishes, the poise of the pure witness, Sakshi. It may look on the action of nature as a thing from which it stands apart. It watches, but does not itself participate. We have seen the importance of this quietistic capacity. It is the basis of the movement of withdrawal by which we can say of everything, body, life, mental action, thought, sensation, emotion, this is Prakriti working in the life, mind, and body. It is not myself. It is not even mine. And thus come to the soul's separation from these things and to their quiescence. This may therefore be an attitude of renunciation, or at least of non-participation, tamasic, with a resigned and inert endurance, titiksha, of the natural action so long as it lasts, rajasic, with a disgust, aversion, and recoil from it, sattvic, with a luminous intelligence of the soul's separateness and the peace and joy of aloofness and repose. But also, it may be attended by an equal and impersonal delight, as of a spectator at a show, joyous but unattached, and ready to rise up at any moment and as joyfully depart. The attitude of the witness at its highest is the absolute of unattachment and freedom from affection by the phenomena of the cosmic existence. So this is the pole of being that he would call Purusha. As the pure witness, the soul refuses the function of upholder or sustainer of nature. This is the poise of Purusha as Sakshi. The upholder, Bharata, is another, God or force or Maya, but not the soul, which only admits the reflection of the natural action upon its watching consciousness, but not any responsibility for maintaining or continuing it. It does not say, all this is in me and maintained by me, an activity of my being, but at the most, this is imposed on me, but really external to myself. Unless there is a clear and real duality in existence, this cannot be the whole truth of the matter. The soul is the upholder also. It supports in its being the energy which unrolls the spectacle of the cosmos and which conducts its energies. Yes, he is saying that that may be the viewpoint of Sankhya. It is not the viewpoint of the Gita, and it does not answer to his own experience either. Because where we are going is this grand fusion of Purusha and Prakriti. Not in the externalities, not in what seems to be divided in nature, but we have to find that secret union. When the Purusha accepts this upholding, it may do it still passively and without attachment, feeling that it contributes the energy, but not that it controls and determines it. And in fact, this can lead to a whole branch of theistic theology. The control is another, God or force or the very nature of Maya. The soul only upholds indifferently so long as it must. So long, perhaps, as the force of its past sanction and interest in the energy continues and refuses to be exhausted. But if the attitude of the upholder is fully accepted, an important step forward has been taken towards identification with the active Brahman and his joy of cosmic being. For the Purusha has become the active giver of the sanction, Anumantha. And here we see this early view of Purusha Prakriti from the insights of Kapila, recorded in a sort of proto-Sankhya perspective, come into oneness with the early Upanishads, which were intent upon discovering the absolute, the spirit, silent and above all manifestation, but also to find that same reality expressed in the entirety of the universe, and the seeker looking for answers. In the attitude of the witness, there is also a kind of sanction, but it is passive, inert, and has no kind of absoluteness about it. So in this attitude of the witness, there is also a kind of sanction, which means even to watch, simply to watch, is to encourage the performance of nature. Simply to see it gives it permission to go. But if he consents entirely to uphold, the sanction has become active. So this is shifting from the Purusha as mere sakshi, witness, to the Purusha as bharta, to uphold. The sanction has become active, even though the soul may do no more than consent to reflect, support, and thereby maintain in action all the energies of Prakriti. So here Sri Aurobindo is basically saying that Purusha is never really fully divorced, but its consent to watch and to passively support and to uphold is enough to justify the nature and the play. It may refuse to determine, to select, believing that it is God or force itself or some knowledge will that selects and determines, and the soul only a witness and upholder and thereby giver of the sanction, Anumantha, but not the possessor and the director of the knowledge and the will, Jnataha Ishwaraha. By the way, that last phrase in the Sanskrit is of Sri Aurobindo's own origination. I find that nowhere in Indian philosophy except here. Then there is a general sanction in the form of an active upholding of whatever is determined by God or universal will, but there is not an active determination. So a general sanction, but not an active determination. But if the soul habitually selects and rejects in what is offered to it, it determines. Because then it's saying yes and no. The relatively passive has become an entirely active sanction and is on the way to be an active control. And thus, spirit enters into nature, the seeming division between Purusha and Prakriti begins to disappear. The gulf is closed. There is a living interface, an active interface between them. By the way, if you like to look at things side by side as Sri Aurobindo is going along, of course, he was writing an essay at the same time as this one in the synthesis, in Essays on the Gita, in which he was, he titled it Sankhya, Yoga, and Vedanta. And that's what we're reading here, basically. And at around the same time, in his record of yoga, I think it was on the 22nd of January, he had a couple of sentences which he noted down in which some of these same terms occur. For the first time today, quoting him, the Ishvara is the Sakshi and not the Jiva. At the same time, the Ishvara Jnata, Bharta, Anumanta, Karta is being rapidly strengthened. So he was pulling into an inner poise where he was simply watching, but the Ishvara consciousness was pressing into him and making the knowledge, the power, more present in his physical and psychological being. So it's interesting that he would be writing this within a few weeks of this essay coming into play. If he published this in April, he probably wrote it in March. This it becomes when the soul accepts its complete function as the knower, lord, and enjoyer of nature. As the knower, the soul possesses the knowledge of the force that acts and determines. It sees the values of being which are realizing themselves in cosmos. It is in the secret of fate. For the force that acts is itself determined by the knowledge, which is its origin and the source and standardizer of its valuations and effectuations of values. So in this movement to erase duality and restore unity psychologically, he now depicts that there is a metaphysical distinction to be made between chit-shakti as power, which expresses itself through knowledge as force. Force effectuates the sight that exists within the strength and the power of chit-shakti. Therefore, in proportion as the soul becomes again the knower, it gets the capacity of becoming also the controller of the action, whether by spiritual force alone, tapasya, chit-shakti, or by that force figuring itself in mental and physical activities. There may be in our soul life a perfect spiritual knowledge and understanding, not only of all our internal activities, but of all the unrolling of things, events, human, animal, natural activities around us, the world vision of the Rishi, a true cosmic consciousness. This may not be attended by an active putting forth of power upon the world, though that is seldom entirely absent, for the Rishi is not uninterested in the world or in his fellow creatures, but one with them by sympathy or by accepting all creatures as his own self in many minds and bodies. The old forest-dwelling anchorites even are described continually as busily engaged in doing good to all creatures. This can only be done in the spiritual realization, not by an effort, for effort is a diminution of freedom, but by a spiritual influence or by a spiritual mastery over the minds of men and the workings of nature, which reflects the divine effective immanence and the divine effective mastery. So this is a spontaneity of empowerment that flows out of this awakened being, feeling the oneness vibrant in all things. And so it doesn't have to think and plan and plot and arrange an architecture of advance. It doesn't have to strategize. Simply, its influence overwhelms. And there's the old adages in Indian spiritual history of natural enemies. When they come into the ambit of one who holds this realization, who lives in this peace, who lives in the power of this consciousness, that they settle down and abide as allies, as friends, in the presence of that living oneness. Nor can it do this without becoming the active enjoyer, mukta. In the lower being, the enjoyment is of a twofold kind, positive and negative, which in the electricity of sensation translates itself into joy and suffering. But in the higher, it is an actively equal enjoyment of the divine delight in self-manifestation, samarasya. That enjoyment, again, may be limited to a silent spiritual delight or an integral divine joy possessing all things around us and all activities of all parts of our being. So we can place ourselves in the transcendent quiet and silence of the unwalled Atman awareness. We can enter into what is here distributed through Atma Shakti into innumerable beings and find that same delight. Ananda only exists. There is no loss of freedom, no descent into an ignorant attachment. The man free in his soul is aware that the divine is the Lord of the action of nature, that Maya is his knowledge will determining and affecting all, that force is the will side of this double divine power in which knowledge is always present and effectual. So he mentions Maya again, and now it becomes really clear that he's not talking about Maya as a power of deceit. He is talking about Maya as a force of the divine consciousness that laying hold upon the infinite wrenches of the Supreme Being measures it out into a meaningful and rich symbol of that. The immeasurable becomes the measured through the power of Maya. He is aware of himself also, even individually, as a center of the divine existence, a portion of the Lord, the Gita expresses it, controlling so far the action of nature which he views, upholds, sanctions, enjoys, knows, and by the determinative power of knowledge controls. Well, we talked about that. This also could be Gita, chapter 15, shloka 7, in which he's talking about the portion of the Lord, that would be jiva bhutaha sanatana. It is an eternal portion of me that becomes the jiva in the world of living creatures. And when he universalizes himself, his knowledge still reflects only the divine knowledge. His will effectuates only the divine will. He enjoys only the divine delight and not an ignorant personal satisfaction. Thus, the Purusha preserves its freedom in its possession. Renunciation of limited personality, even in its representative enjoyment and delight of cosmic being. It has taken up fully in the higher poise the true relations of the soul and nature. So one does not negative the other. They are complementary. Purnam madaha, purnam midam. The higher poise, para prakriti. Purusha and prakriti in their union and duality arise from the being of Satchit Ananda. Again, we get our earliest mentions of Satchit Ananda in theistic Vedanta, like the Muktika Upanishad. But later, we also see it in texts that are evocative and worshipful towards the Divine Mother, Sri Lalita Sahasranama, where she's called Satchid Ananda Rupani. Self-conscious existence is the essential nature of the being. That is Sat or Purusha. The power of self-aware existence, whether drawn into itself or acting in the works of its consciousness and force, its knowledge and its will, chit and tapas, chit and its shakti, that is prakriti. Delight of being, ananda, is the eternal truth of the union of this conscious being and its conscious force, whether absorbed in itself or else deployed in the inseparable duality of its two aspects. So Sri Aurobindo here is throwing away the gulf of division that Sankhya as a dualistic philosophy imposes on these two terms, Purusha and Prakriti. He's saying, not for me. They are poles of that one. Delight of being, ananda, is the eternal truth of the union of this conscious being and its conscious force, whether absorbed in itself or else deployed in the inseparable duality of its two aspects. It unrolls the worlds as prakriti and views them as purusha. See, this is a possibility that comes into being in the supramental consciousness itself. And now we see here Sri Aurobindo referring to that unitive manner by which oneness has become multiple, by which harmony grows out naturally as a spontaneous expression of that sheer being above. Acts in them and upholds the action, executes works and gives the sanction without which the force of nature cannot act, executes and controls the knowledge and the will, and knows and controls the determinations of the knowledge force and will force. Ministers to the enjoyment and enjoys. All is the sole possessor, observer, knower, lord of nature, and nature expressing the being, executing the will, satisfying the self-knowledge, ministering to the delight of being of the soul. There we have, founded on the very nature of being, the supreme and the universal relation of prakriti with purusha. The relation in its imperfect, perverted, reversed terms is the world as we see it. But the perfect relation brings the absolute joy of the soul in itself. And based upon that, the absolute joy of the soul in nature, which is the divine fulfillment of world existence. Next week we'll take up the soul and its liberation. So, let's go to one of these great passages from Savitri. Book 1, The Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. We'll begin on page 60. All here, where each thing seems its lonely self, are figures of the sole transcendent one. Only by him they are, his breath is their life. An unseen presence molds the oblivious clay. A playmate in the mighty mother's game, one came upon the dubious whirling globe to hide from her pursuit in force and form. A secret spirit in the inconscient sleep, a shapeless energy, a voiceless word, he was here before the elements could emerge, before there was light of mind or life could breathe. Accomplice of her cosmic huge pretense, his semblances he turns to real shapes and makes the symbol equal with the truth. He gives to his timeless thoughts a form in time. He is the substance, he the self of things. She has forged from him her works of skill and might. She wraps him in the magic of her moods and makes of his myriad truths her countless dreams. The master of being has come down to her, an immortal child born in the fugitive years, in objects wrought, in the persons she conceives. Dreaming, she chases her idea of him and catches here a look and there a jest. Ever he repeats in them his ceaseless births. He is the maker and the world he made. He is the vision and he is the seer. He is himself the actor and the act. He is himself the knower and the known. He is himself the dreamer and the dream. There are two who are one and play in many worlds. In knowledge and ignorance they have spoken and met, and light and darkness are their eyes interchange. Our pleasure and pain are their wrestle and embrace. Our deeds, our hopes are intimate to their tale. They are married secretly in our thought and life. The universe is an endless masquerade, for nothing here is utterly what it seems. It is a dream fact vision of a truth, which, but for the dream, would not be wholly true. A phenomenon stands out significant against dim backgrounds of eternity. We accept its face and pass by all it means. A part is seen, we take it for the whole. Thus have they made their play, with us for roles. Author and actor, with himself as seen, he moves there as the soul, as nature she. Here on the earth, where we must fill our parts, we know not how shall run the drama's course, our uttered sentences veil in their thought. Her mighty plan she holds back from our sight. She has concealed her glory and her bliss, and disguised the love and wisdom in her heart. Of all the marvel and beauty that are hers, only a darkened little we can feel. It's a great passage. Why don't we finish it next time? And in fact, back up and do that last sentence again. Namaste, Jai Ma.